Okay, Boker Tov. Good morning, everybody. Before we start, just want to firstly thank. I'd like to thank the people involved with, firstly with the attendees, people coming on a regular basis, and many people have come, not such a regular basis, but you know, a number of people have been here, and we've had what I call very respectable numbers for the first semester that we've had. Today will be our last session for a couple of weeks. We're just coming into vacation period, and I have quite a heavy period of stuff going on in college, so we'll after today we'll meet in January 22nd, so it's about 4 weeks. Okay, so I just want to make that, so you put that into your I think it's Wednesday the 22nd, just after Luther King, the week of Luther King, when everything starts up again in terms of school and whatever. That will be the first session of what I'm calling the spring semester. Okay, we've just finish the fall semester, and then we'll be on to the spring semester. Thinking about spring, hopefully it won't be snowing. Obviously, if we have any problems with the weather, and it's obvious that things will not happen, then, you know, I think that will be, let's say if there's a school day, for instance, and the people can't get here, then obviously the session will be cancelled for that week. We'll try to get a message out somehow. I'll have to talk to Rabbi Epstein about it, how we can get a message out that people will know whether the session is happening, because this is now. Yeah, I mean, ideally through email and whatever, but not everybody has email. Yes, so we'll have to work that one out. And obviously, coming into January, February, there might be some days where we might be challenged, but let's hope for the best. You know, so far December, you know, we're doing okay. So I pray that the weather will be cold, but let's hope it won't be more than that. In terms of where we're at, we're really halfway through the Megillah, which is pretty good, right? So I'm excited in the fact that next semester, hopefully, we'll be able to finish the whole Megillah by the time we get to Purim, which will be really nice. It will certainly give you something more to think about, something more to be aware of when we read the Megillah on Purim, please God, on the holiday, which will be around sometime in March. What I'm going to do today, two things. Up to chapter 5, we saw the discussion about Mordechai and Esther becoming much more connected to the Jewish community, and the fact that they stand up and they are counted, and Esther's going to go to the king, and she tells Mordechai to fast, tells the people to come together, and there is this sense all of a sudden of the community becoming Jewish, becoming aware of their Judaism, becoming aware of their Jewish roots. And we saw, the last thing we saw at the end of chapter 4 was that Yavor Mordechai, he was even prepared to break the law of Pesach. You know, at the end of the day, Jews, even the most assimilated Jews, do keep some sort of Passover celebration. We know that. And Mordechai was prepared to accept, and for the community to accept, that they would fast for 3 days. Some say it was the 14th, the 15th, and the 16th of Nisan. Okay, because remember, this whole discussion, what's going on at the moment with the king and Esther, is happening in Nisan. They've got a whole year to go before the decree is carried out, if it's going to be carried out. So,
can you discuss why they delayed
it
a year?
Yeah, and we said it gives enough time. I mean, it was really Min HaShemayim, gives the Jews enough. It was, the idea was to give enough time for all the messengers to get to the furthest end of the empire. You know, not like today where you send an email and it's there in literally 1 second. It was much more complicated, and also gave time for, and this was a bracha, to give time for the Jewish people to prepare their defense in case it would come to the bottom line, which essentially it did. And instead, of course, of the Jews being overwhelmed, they managed to fight back, and we get the whole story at the end, which is, to me, one of the most disturbing parts of the story. But we'll come to that next in a few weeks' time. And then we did speak about that. So, two things I want to share with you. Number one is a style which is found. Those of you who study Tanakh, and you're lucky enough to be in Israel, and you go to various institutions, wherever it may be, Gush Etzion or one of the university courses or whatever it is, there is a very popular style which has developed in the last few years looking for what is called Mila Mancha or Milim Manchim. Milim Manchim means that there are keywords. In a sefer like Megillat Esther, what is the key word of the sefer? Or there may be a number. What we mean by keyword, it's a word that repeats itself over and over again. And when that word repeats itself over and over again, we have to look at the context of where that word or that particular phrase appears. And I've mentioned this, and this is why I gave you this rather unreadable page. You've got the whole Megillah through to chapter 7 on one page. And the whole idea is not to give you give your optometrist something to worry about. The whole idea here is just to show you, if you look at the column on the right hand side, I've underlined, if you'll see where the underlinings are, and I've tried to underline for you the word Malka. And it's something I mentioned before. The word Malka is a word that appears over and over again. Malka means queen. And it's over and over again, chapter 1, and you'll see it comes chapter 2 eventually. And it's significant because of what we're going to learn today in chapter 5. And what happens with the word Amalka is that it is a key word. It really gives us an insight into so many things that are going on in the Megillah. And without understanding the power of the word Malka, we won't understand the beginning of chapter 5, Perikei, which is what we're learning today. So let me just show you, Bekitsa, very briefly, what you've got on the page. The right-hand column, about a third of the way down, you have underlined Vashti HaMalka. We spoke about this. Originally, Vashti was HaMalka. She was the queen. She's the Yichus. She's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Go down to the next underlining, Lahavid Vashti HaMalka. And Ahasuerus wants to establish his authority. So he wants to bring Vashti HaMalka into the big party because he wants everybody to see her at his command. He's in charge. And then go two lines down, it's HaMalka Vashti. She refuses because she says, HaMalka, I'm in charge. I'm the Malka. I'm the queen. Right? So just by looking at the underlinings, you see the power already of the word Malka. They're playing around with this word in the Megillah to emphasize the power of the person, in this case, Vashti. And look what happens when you go a couple of lines down. You've got, again, Malka Vashti. It's about halfway down on the right-hand side. And then you've got underneath, Avtah Vashti HaMalka. She made a sin by not going to the party. She refused to go. And look what happens when you go down to verse Yutet, verse 19. Literally just over halfway down on the right, Lo Tavo Vashti, I put it in a box, Lo Tavo Vashti without the word Malka. Right? This is the other page. Ah, it's not that page.
I'm going to give you this page. This is the one we're looking at.
Yeah, sorry. What has happened by the time you get down to verse 19, the word Malka has been dropped. All of a sudden, Vashti is no longer HaMalka. She doesn't have the power. Right, she's not in charge anymore. And by the time you get to beginning of chapter 2, it says, Melech Achashverosh Zacharet Vashti. He remembered Vashti, but not Vashti or Malka. And we explained that the word Malka is so significant because for the king, he wanted to become absolute. His power was going to be absolute. And as long as Vashti HaMalka was there, it always reminded him that he was beholden to her. He had to go to her for permission to do anything. Because she was the boss. She was the descendant of the great Nebuchadnezzar. So according to what we're saying now, the use of the word Malka, which is significantly dropped after Vashti is executed, is for us a guide as to when the word appears later on in the Megillah regarding Esther. Is Esther going to be known immediately as Esther HaMalka, or just Esther without the word Malka? And in fact, in chapter 2, we already get this situation. Look at the last six lines on the right hand side. We read this, Atilokach Esther El Hamelech, right? Esther was taken to the king. No Esther Malka at this point. It then says, Lo higida Esther et amav et moladata. Esther did not reveal her background. And again, no Esther Hamalka. However, when it comes to the middle section, and you'll see here, I've got one underlining in the middle section, about 12 lines down, it's talking about the meal that the king made in celebration of marrying Esther. What does it say there? It's eight mishtei Esther, not Esther Amalka. Even though she's now the queen because the king has married her, or the king is living with her, whatever, the reality is she still does not merit the word Malka. And although you have the word Malka in the story with Mordechai and the two conspirators, and it says in verse Kaf Bet, which is about a third of the way down, Vayivodah davar leMordechai v'yaged leEsther haMalka. For him, Mordechai, she is already Malka. But for Achashverosh, she isn't. She is Esther. And here it's Toma Esther lemela b'shei Mordechai. When she goes to the king, she is allowed to be Esther, one of the women, but not Esther haMalka. For her uncle, for Mordechai, of course she's Malka. What does Malka mean? She's descending from a family of kings. She comes from the family of Saul, the king of Israel. That's her ancestor. So she is a Malka. Of course she is. Right? She's a queen. But in terms of Achashverosh, the whole point was he wanted to drop the Malka business because he wants to be the boss. He doesn't want to have a Malka. Because as soon as he has a Malka, his authority begins to be undermined. Yeah. So, just so interesting.
But I thought in that era of civilization, women didn't have much position.
That's true, except in this case, because she really was the link to Nebuchadnezzar.
Well, we know that, but in general, women were subservient.
But not... Yeah.
He's insecure then.
Yeah, he is actually very insecure. According to rabbinic tradition, he was nothing more than a stable hand in the palace. He looked after the horses, right? And it's so interesting that the only reason he got up the ladder was because he married the right woman. So his whole rise to fame is because of her.
Wasn't he an officer or something?
Eventually, once he's king, yeah, but that wasn't him. That was Haman and Mordechai. They became officers in the army. Right, he's the king of the army, so therefore eventually he becomes the king, but he's always bound to Vashti because of her grandfather. Right? That's what happens. You marry money, that's what it is, you know, that's where the money's coming from.
Something to say about women in Hitchit in Thailand, for example. The old czar, famous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would have queens, you certainly would have recognizable queens. It's just so, I mean, you're right, because Persia was not famous for being, how should we say, you know, like they say today, not famous for its equality. No, really not famous for that. And certainly even today, it's not famous for its equality either. As we know, in Persia, it's a madhouse. But the reality is, and this is something that I heard from a lecturer in Bar-Ilan, Meir Tzvi Grisman is a wonderful, wonderful guy. And he explains that the power of the word Malka is so significant because, again, between Mordechai and Esther, she's already, in his eyes, she's Malka. You want to call her the Jewish princess, whatever you want to call her, but she is already the queen. He knows her yichus, he knows who she is. But for Achashverosh, no, she's Esther. And it's insignificant because, again, we started off with Vashti being Hamalka all the way through till Vashti is executed and then she is just Vashti. Now Esther has taken over, but she's not Esther Malka yet. In the eyes of the king, she's still Esther. What happens is, look down the page and you'll see begin where it says chapter 4. It's about 6 lines from the bottom of the middle column. V'hamelev ha'aman yashu lishtot. Sorry, I thought that was talking about Esther. No, that's just the end of the chapter. So further down, it says, 3 lines from the bottom of the middle column, Esther. When she's in the palace, she is not Esther Hamalka yet. She's got women serving her, whatever. However, where it says, Vatit Chalchala Malka Ma'od, again, why is she becoming so affected and afraid by what's going on? Because of what she's hearing, particularly, this is more connected with her relationship, I would guess, to Mordechai, It's one of the Amalkas, which, you know, you have to work a bit harder to explain. But look at the bottom line. Vatikra Esther Lahatach, when she's having this whole conversation backwards and forwards with Mordechai, like we learned last week, she's just Esther. The word Malka does not appear. So if you go to the third column, again, you've got about the sixth line down, Natan Laharodet Esther, right? That the document which was sent out to destroy the Jews was shown to Esther again without Malka. And then Vayageid, three lines down, La Esther, again, without the word Malka. Vatoma Esther Atach, the whole way through the parsha of chapter 4 that we read last week, it's Esther all the way. If you just follow them all the way through to chapter 5, it's Esther, Esther, and Esther. Look at chapter 5, and you've got it on that page, Vayihi Bayom HaShlishi, where we're starting today. Just going to read it from that page that I gave you. Valtibash Esther Malchut. Esther wore kingship. What does that mean? All of a sudden, there is a play on the use of Malka, Malchut, the use of kingship. What does it mean that Esther tilbash, levush? Levush means to wear. What does it mean, beginning of chapter 5, which is where we're at now, that Esther starts to wear kingship? Says Rashi, and then if you open the text that you have, it's around page, what is it, 1256, chapter 5. Alright, these pages you can put away for them, I will come back to them. These illegible pages of the Megillah, but I just wanted to show you this use of Amalka and how it's going to become so significant as we go along. Look again at the beginning of chapter 5. Vayihi b'yom ha-shlishi. It was on the third day after the troubles were announced, and the rabbis make a big play about the fact that we have lots of Yom Shlishis in the Torah. The Torah was given after 3 days of preparation, Shloshi Dimei Agbalah. The Akedah happened after 3 days. So this idea, remember, they were traveling for 3 days. So there's many examples of where 3 days is a significant period of time. I think that there is something to be said here. This is Rabbi Bachar points this out, that here also Esther being, as it were, more proactive on the third day, Bayom HaShlishi, is within the Jewish tradition of things happening within 3 days. Third day. There's so many examples of 3 day period which is being referred to here, and that's on the other page that I gave you, section A. And again, I'll just show you one or two examples, but I want to do some text first. Look back to chapter 5. Listen to this. Vayihi bayom ha-shlishi v'tulbash Esther malchut. She wore kingship. The translation here, clothed herself regally. What does that mean? Says Rashi, the most interesting comment, Big Day Malchut, the word Big Day is missing. She wore clothes of kingship, right? If you switch on tomorrow, I think it is, there's a channel that shows the British Parliament, I've forgotten now. C-SPAN or something like that, right? Whatever you can, if you want to see it, the Queen is opening Parliament. That's Big Day Malchut. You should see what she wears. Unbelievable. With the crown and the whole business. Right? And that's the clothing. But here, Rabotenu Amru, Rashi just brings, what does it mean that she wore Malchut? The rabbis say, Shelovashta Ruach HaKodesh. She became enveloped in Holy Spirit. Wow. Malchut, obviously here, has got a much bigger connotation. Not that she just wore the clothing, but she started having the charisma. She walked into the room, and all of a sudden, people started, that's the queen, right? The queen of England can do this. She walks into a room, and everybody goes absolutely, almost, you know, like zombies. They all stop walking, they stop breathing. When the queen walks in, I didn't have that experience, but my parents and I went to Buckingham Palace, and they said, as soon as she approaches, everybody stands to attention, and they start nodding and doing all strange things. You know, the real malchut, real kingship, does have with it a certain charisma. And that's what's happening here. Vatilbash Esther Malchut, she starts wearing this sense of, he calls it Ruach HaKodesh, there is a godly a sense of the divine right of kings, right? Shakespeare spoke about it. The whole idea that there is around, surrounding her, a spirit of holiness. And what happened? Look how interesting this is. Look at this verse. Continues. V'ta'amod b'chatzar beit ha'melech p'nimit. She's standing, waiting to be let in to see the king. Nochach beit ha'melech, outside the king's palace. V'ha'melech yoshev akisi malchuto b'beit ha'malchut. Look at the malchut, melech, malchut, malchut. It's stressing this whole thing of kingship, that he is determined to be number one. And all of a sudden, she's wearing the clothing and the ambiance of kingship. Nochach petach habayit. What happens? Verse 2. Listen to this. Vayehi kirot hamelech. He's the king. And what does he see? Et Esther hamalka. He sees Esther the queen. Now you'll say, okay, she's the queen. But till now, he's been very reluctant to call her hamalka. He hasn't, when they've been together, he's just referred to her as Esther, right? And the only time we saw Malkah was when she was on her own and she was afraid, or with Mordechai. But when she's with the king, he never refers to her as Esther HaMalkah. He refers to her as Esther. Because think about it, the last thing he needs is another Vashti. He got rid of Vashti number one, and to marry a girl with Yichus and with a kingship and all the rest of it, he gets Vashti number two, he hasn't gained anything. He is a very scheming individual, Achashverosh. He's not a fool. And if he goes and marries another queen with the yichas going back to King Saul and everything that entails, he's in trouble.
Does he know
he has yichas? No, not yet.
But he
senses it. That's why I explained. It's like the queen walking into the room. If she walks in, you don't know who she is. You've got that sense that somebody different has just walked into the room. Can't explain it, right? Body language, the way she holds herself. I mean, the Queen of England is very unique because she wears the same style of clothes, the hat, the whole presentation of the Queen. She's 95. She's an amazing woman. She just did horse riding a month ago. Go figure that one. 95 years old. Can you know her hips are okay? Getting on a horse, I'm not going to get on a horse at my age, let alone 95 years old. And she's doing that. She's an amazing woman, right? Her mother was also an amazing woman. She lived to 103, her mother, I think. Sorry, yeah.
Why does it say that Esther, when he gives her the...
Wait a second. Hang on. Because now he senses that there's something unique about her that he's never seen before. So he says he saw Esther Malkah. Just look at the verse. Omedet b'chatzer, standing in the courtyard. Nasachem b'beinam. Firstly, he likes her. Vayoshet ha-melech le-Esther. Not Esther ha-malka. He wants to show that he's in control. What's the act of dominance? By stretching out his scepter. You know, he's got some sort of big, whatever it is, a spear or something. Et shavit ha-zahav asher b'yado, a golden scepter. Vatikrav Esther, not ha-malka. She comes near Vatigab Rosh Hashavit, and she pays reverence to it, pays respect by touching the scepter. In other words, he is not prepared to give her the title yet, Amalka, but in his mind, in his imagination, he's beginning to see a different side to her. And look what happens now in verse 3. Vayom Allah HaMelech, always stressing HaMelech. He's trying to preserve his situation. Malach Esther Malka? Question mark. What do you want, Esther Hamalka? And you can read this not as we normally read it, as a simple question, but as a statement of amazement. Esther Hamalka, you're not Esther. You're not the queen. You are. I mean, you know, I chose you out of all the women, but all of a sudden, I'm getting the vibe from you that there's a bit more to you than I realized. I'll give you till half of the kingdom. Esther, not a Malka. She realizes that he's beginning to twig who she really is. And she knows that, you know what? I've got to pull back a bit. Because if I get too brazen at this point of the story, he's just going to send me off to the executioner and I'm done. He doesn't care because, you know, this is Achashverosh, he's king of the world. So if I now overstep my situation and say to him or show him that I am Malkah, absolutely queen at this point, he's not going to go for that. He already twigged by the time I walked in the room with a certain amount of spiritual accompaniment, right, that God was with him. There's a whole discussion about going into the room and not having idolatry in the room. And the rabbis play on all of this. And it says, Esther felt to herself, I'm worried that, you know what's going to happen? He may get too overwhelmed by the concept of me being the queen, which he doesn't want, the yichus, he'll get rid of me. So Esther steps back. But and pasuk dalet vatoma Esther imal hamelech tom, Yivo HaMelech v'Haman Hayom Ela Mishteh Asher Asiti Lo. And she says to the king, come and bring Haman to the meal that I will make Lo for him. How many men are coming to the meal?
Just two.
Two. But the Hebrew Lo means to him. Not, I should have said, to them. Lahem. So here, what is Esther doing? She is buttering up Achashverosh. I'm making him. In other words, I am specifically going to make a meal, and that meal, you come because it's in your honor, O king. Bring Haman because there's something else that I need to achieve in this meal. And of course, the king's mind starts racing. What does the king say to himself? He says, all right, I know she wants to make a meal for me. And think about meals. Who was the last person that made a big suitor that he got had such trouble? Vashti. And he got rid of her. So having a meal from the queen, for him, is not such a great invitation. He's beginning to worry. This meal invitation, thank you very much, but you know, I could do without the meal. I don't need to go to the restaurant. I don't need it. And he is deliberating what's going on. And again, it's so fascinating because you can see, if you sort of read it so closely, you can see that there is within the dialogue here more nuance than we ever imagined. Esther initially walks in with this sense of royalty, Malkah. The king kind of gets a bit of a shock and he sits back. And then she tones it down a bit and becomes just Esther. But at the same time, come tomorrow and I'm making him, in other words, I'm making for the king a meal, bring Haman anyway. I'll show you why this is so interesting, because there's a change in the verse later on. When she repeats the invitation, she doesn't say lo to him, but then she says lahem, to them. She includes Haman in the invitation properly. I'm making food for you and I'm making food for him as well. But here it's law. Initially it's for him. It's an invitation for the king, and bring him along because he's the prime minister and I want him to be there. But of course she doesn't say why. So the king's mind is racing. All of a sudden he sees a meal and he sees Esther who looked more than what I thought she was. I thought she was just, you know, one of the pretty women in the harem. All of a sudden, look what she's becoming. And although she stepped back from that, there is this sense of her, you know, sort of who knows what she's going to do in the process of this meal. Look what happens. Pasuk Hey. And this is why this chapter is so interesting. Verse 5. Vayomer HaMelech. Always stressing. He's trying to keep his position going. And strangely, Maharu et Haman. He says, not only bring Haman, but make it quick. All of a sudden, and this is what Rav Lau points out, things start to go into, let's say we were running, if you're driving a stick, you're running at about second or third gear. All of a sudden, things go into fifth gear. They start going crazy. Maharu, everything starts happening really, really quickly. Maharu et Haman, lasod et devar Esther. The king says, hurry, bring Haman to do the word of the queen, but not using the word Malkah, again, very significant. And look what happens in the end of verse 5. Vayavo HaMelech v'Haman. They both come, but Vayavo, the singular, because at the moment the focus is still on the king. El HaMishteh Asher Asta Esther. It's still only Esther. He is still trying to establish that although she's invited me, and the meal might become significant, that she will take control and become the Vashti that I wanted to get rid of in the first place, I'm going to go because you know what? The king is intrigued. Who is she? He still doesn't know who she is. He knows that she's very pretty and he knows what she's in the, that she won the competition or whatever, but he's still intrigued. He's not sure. And look what happens in verse 6. Vayomer HaMelech le Esther. Again, not recognizing the word Malkah, not calling her queen. He says, B'mishtei ayayin, Ma she'elotech v'yinatein lach, what do you want? Ma bakashotech ad chatzia malchut v'teyas, I'll give you half the kingdom. Say the rabbis, why only half? Because if she asked for the Jewish temple to be rebuilt, as an example for him, he would never give it. He is part of that whole crew of people who refused to allow the second temple to be built. Remember, we had Cyrus who allowed it, and then after that, it was put on hold, and Ahasuerus was one of those negative voices. So that's what the rabbis point out, which again fits in sort of interestingly into what we've been saying before. Yeah, they make a derision. Look at again, Rashi points this out. Chatzi ha-malchut davashu be'emtza. Chatzi meaning not half the kingdom, something which is in the middle of the kingdom. Where was Jerusalem? Right in the middle of the world. We believe Jerusalem's emtza olam. Right? So Rashi plays on the middle and says, you know what? What he's saying is, I'll give you everything till we get to Jerusalem, but don't ask me about Jerusalem. That's off the table. Right? Whatever you want. And why he mentions Yerushalayim is not clear according to Rashi, because she hasn't told him yet who she is, but he's probably giving her an example of certain things that she can never ask for. Yeah, if she wants to be involved with a project and she heard about the temple in Jerusalem, that is not for negotiation at this point. That's the way Rashi plays it by the word chatzi. It's a stretch, but it's interesting. Listen to this. Look how it goes on. And here comes the bombshell. This is point number two that I want to deal with. Because now that I think we're sensitive to the use of the word malkah, we now have to ask ourselves, what is going on with Esther and the queen and the king at this point? Esther is doing something here which we said she's playing with fire. She could be executed literally at the whim of Ahasuerus, especially if he's worried that she is conniving with Haman against the king. Remember, this is Persia of the biblical era, and Ahasuerus, as we saw historically, was not very successful. On the contrary, he really was not. He'd lost wars, and therefore, you know what? Maybe Esther is now conniving with Haman. Haman's become very big, and she is his ticket to overthrow Ahasuerus. So he is clearly in a position where he is trying to establish his authority without question. So what he's avoiding, absolute avoidance, is to call Esther Malkah. She has got to know that she is under my authority. She touched the scepter, and the way that it works, even though I'm coming to her meal, it's done out of honor for me. Look what happens at the first meal, verse 6. Esther said, this is my request. Verse 8. If I found favor in your eyes, and it's good for the king to do what I want, then Yovo Hamelech Vahaman, you've got to come back. El ha-mishteh she'eseh lahem. Plural. I'm now including Haman absolutely in the invitation. She started off by saying lo to him, and now she says lohem to them, including Haman. She knows that at this moment, at meal number one, for her to start pleading for the Jewish people is, as they say, a brocha levatola. It's not going to happen. So she decides, with all of the realization that she might have pushed the king a bit too hard on round one, she says, you've got to come back for round two. Machar e'eseh kidavar hamela. Tomorrow I will do as the king asked. And the Mepharshim say, because the king wanted to know who she was, and that's the whole discussion here. What's going to happen tomorrow? She promises the king, there's a reason for you to come, because you'll find out once and for all who I am. Haman, at this point, just cannot believe his luck. Because he doesn't get all of the interaction between the king and queen here. All he can see is that he started off being the plus one, as you say when you go to the party. And all of a sudden, instead of being the plus one, the guy you bring with, he's now the main invite with the king. Lohem, she's now cooking for both of them. She's preparing for both of them. And at this point, look at verse 9. I'm just going to finish the chapter, and then we'll look at the page that I gave you. Because there is something about tomorrow which is absolutely overwhelming. I always tell my students, there is one point of the lesson. Every time that we learn together, the whole lesson is important. But there's one revelation that comes out sometimes by chance, which makes it worth getting out of bed that day. I put it in those terms. They all look at me as if I'm crazy, because, you know, they're students. They don't want to get up in the morning. I mean, you know, they're students partying all night. But the reality is that I try and make it exciting, because it is exciting. Look what's going on over here, verse 9. V'yetzei Haman b'yamo sameach v'tov lev. So Haman, Mr. Big, is gone, and he's so happy. Ukiraot Haman et Mordechai b'shar ha-melech. He sees the Yiddel sitting there. V'lo kam v'lo zam imenu. Mordechai still not getting up, and still not taking off his hat. He's angry at Mordechai. And again, so interesting that you'll see Rashi is going to make an allusion to the whole thing that we spoke about with Mordechai and Haman in the army. This, again, is part of the personal animosity that Mordechai has from Haman. Because in the end of the day, he signed a document to Mordechai saying, I'm going to be your servant, I am your slave. And Mordechai is reminding Haman of this commitment that Haman made. Remember the whole thing with the money and etc. So look at verse 10. V'yitapak Haman, he had to hold back, because he wanted to kill Mordechai on the spot. But v'yavol beito, he goes home. He realizes this is not the time or the place to do it. Mordechai will have be dealt with in due course. V'yishlach v'yaveto avav etzeresh ishto, he called all his friends and his wife. Interesting that he seems to be less excited about bringing his wife into the room than his friend, right? And maybe she is the voice of reason. You'll see later on that she doesn't warn him at the beginning, but she says at the end, she's like the 20/20 hindsight, right? The Monday morning quarterback. She says to him, I told you so. I told you shouldn't mess with the Jews. And that comes later. So I think Zeresh gets her own little place of significance, but we'll come back to her. Look at verse 11. Ve'yisaper lehem Haman et kavod ashro v'rov banav. He tells all about everything, that the honor and everything that's happening to him at kol hashei gidlo ha-melech, that he's been elevated by the king, with asher nisal sarim avdei ha-melech, he's now above everybody, he's the prime minister. You'd bet, verse 12, ayomer Haman af lo hivia ester ha-malka. For him, he doesn't have that sensitivity of who she is yet. As far as he's concerned, she's the queen, and she's invited me to the palace, and I'm overwhelmed with the honor. And in fact, not only that, but he's lording it. Imam Melech, she's invited me with the king, Ela Mishter, Asher Asata, which he's making, Ki Im Oti, it's only me. Right? In other words, almost as if he's saying, even the king is irrelevant. Because obviously, put it very bluntly, she fancies me. Right? Maybe I've got something going here, and she likes me, and maybe, who knows what we can concoct together. V'gam l'machar ani karula mamelech, I'm going again tomorrow. We have to ask the question still, which is, although it's explained, we half explained it, why Esther doesn't announce herself on meal number one, but why have the second meal tomorrow? What's going on here? What is this waiting 24 hours? What is that all about? Why does Esther feel there is a precedent here for doing what she did? How has she dealt with this? She's obviously planned something here. What is it based on? We'll come back to this in a minute. She's letting him cook. He's 24 hours. Achashverosh needs to go home and think to himself, what is going on here? Right? I'm going to a meal. I'm not really happy.
Also, both the king
And Haman is thinking, he's thinking, and it's so, you can't just let things happen, as it were, by, you know, what we call knee-jerk reaction. It's got to stew, it's got to have time to percolate, and this is percolating.
Why didn't the king just demand, why didn't you for a second day, tell him what's on your mind?
Yeah, and again, because he is, again, very, I don't know what the word is, he's almost stunned by the way that she's doing this, and he doesn't react in that kind of forceful way. He is still maybe overwhelmed by the fact that he's sensing there's something here with her which is almost unexplainable. He's got to go along with the way that she wants it. He's bound by the way that she has set this whole thing up. And he's intrigued by her, yeah. Yeah, but the first time it wasn't really anything more than a plus one. Now it's Lahem. He's dead center in the invitation. So again, what has happened here, as far as the king, is that You're right. Maybe the king would have been more forceful and said, come on, stop this Kinderspiel. Let's just get on with it. But the king is one of those guys that, you know, maybe he's saying to himself, let me play along with her and see what this is really all about. He's allowing things to develop because he realizes something's going on here. Now, it could be that he's suspicious that Esther and Haman are concocting something. So he wants to catch them together in some sort of dialogue, you know, and this is what happened. Remember, he goes out into the garden, comes back in, and Haman falls on the bed with Esther. So he gets very angry with Haman to the point where he says, take him away and hang him. Right? And that's exactly what happens to Haman. So the reality of it is that the king is super suspicious, but at this point, not enough to commit one way or the other as to what to do next. He's got to come to the second meal. And look what it says here. Haman is saying, b'chol eich ani ro'eh et Mordechai Yehudi, whenever I see Mordechai. And again, this is where Rashi refers to the rabbinic tradition. Haman was shown by Mordechai the document that he is Mordechai's slave, he's Mordechai's servant. He says, Yoshev b'shar melech, Mordechai is sitting there, it makes me crazy. And therefore, along comes Zeresh, Yudala, v'tomelo Zeresh ishto v'cholo avav. This time Zeresh takes the initiative, even though she came in after the friends. But now she stands up and says, Ba'ali, my husband, I tell you what to do. Yasu eitz gavah chamishim ama, make this tall tree that everybody, all from literally all around the neighborhood and beyond, they will see baboker mola mele, tell the king v'idluad Mordechai ala. They will hang Mordechai. And at that point, you'll be done with him. It will become public knowledge that your command overwhelmed Mordechai, and that's the end of it. V'boim ha-melech el-mishteh, and then you can go with the king to the party. She doesn't understand the worry about maybe Haman is being seen as a conspirator. His wife doesn't see it like that at all. As far as she's concerned, it's all about the glory of Haman. Sameach, that he'll go happy. Ve'yitav ha-davar lifnei Haman, ve'yasa'et. And he makes the tree. Unbelievable. Look at the page that I gave you, the second page. And I want to show you something about Machar, because this is phenomenal. On page one, I've divided it into paragraph A, B, C, D. Paragraph D is the one I wanted to go through, but I may come back to it. There are 14 reasons given by the rabbis as to why Esther invites Haman. 14 reasons. Unbelievable. And the only thing that the Gemara says, the Gemara Megillah, after the whole discussion, is that there was a rabbi called Rabba Bar Avua, a very famous rabbi of the Talmud, and he goes to ask Eliyahu Navi, and he says, Elijah, tell me, who is right? There are 14 rabbis all disagreeing about why Haman was invited. Who's right? And you know what Eliyahu says? Typical Jewish answer, they're all right. They're all correct. Everything that every rabbi said, why Haman should have been invited, they all had a point. And one of the interesting things is that Esther is inviting Haman because if the king does get angry and he kills Esther, he'll also kill Haman as well. And that will be the end of it. In other words, Esther is prepared to die for the cause. That's an interesting suggestion. That Esther will invite Haman as well as the king. So if the king really loses it and he suspects sedition and treason and all the rest of it, he'll kill Esther and he'll kill Haman. So they're both gone. But at least Haman is gone. The danger has gone away. So Esther, according to one of the rabbis here, is doing this is prepared to give up her life. Which again, I find very interesting because it fits in what we said last time, that all of a sudden Esther's woken up from just being the woman trying to succeed in Persia. All of a sudden she realizes that as a Jew, she's got to put her life on the line, especially in a position of leadership. What I want to show you, however, is on page 2. Look at paragraph... Oh, where do I start this? It's the last paragraph, it's the last column, and there is halfway down. Three, excuse me. Where it says F on the right, you'll see in the column next to it, there's a 3. Right? And I'm reading that part. V'rayon achem matzan of midrash. The whole reason why there were two parties. Because in the end of the day, it does still beg the question, why drag it all out? And Esther does because it creates more tension. There's no question about it. But what is really going on? Listen to this. This is a quote from a midrash, a very old midrash. Aleph Gimel Aleph, I've forgotten now what that... it's a Yalkut. It's really very old midrashic text. This is number 3 on the left-hand column of the last column of the handout. Ma rata Esther lomar macha esek devar amelet. The rabbis asked, why do it all tomorrow? Why wait 24 hours? Ela yada. This is so unbelievable. Esther knows. Shezaro shel amalek lemudim lipol b'cherev lemacha. She read the Bible. And you know what she saw in the Bible? That Amalek starts attacking the Jewish people, the end of the Parsha of B'Shalah, and 24 hours later is when Amalek is defeated. It takes 24 hours to overcome Amalek. It's not immediate. And she says to herself, I now am fighting Haman. He's the quintessential Amalekite. Amalek ben Agagi. He's from Agag. He was the Amalekite that King Saul failed to kill. So the reality is, I've got to look in the Bible for precedents. And the precedent I found is in the original story of Amalek, where it says it took 24 hours. Tell you an interesting story. Prime Minister, the book of the Prime Ministers, which again, I think if I mention this story to you already, I'll repeat it just for the purpose of repetition, but it's a good story. The gentleman who wrote the book of the Prime Ministers is a gentleman by the name of Yehuda Avner, Zichron Livracha. And he came here, he's from England originally. He went on Akshara, went to Kibbutz Lavi in 1948. My parents in law were with him at that time in Israel. And it's just an interesting story that how he eventually got into the diplomatic corps, and he was the only religious guy. I mean, with Ben-Gurion and with that whole crowd, they didn't want religious people there. But he was the advisor on the Tvutzot, on matters of the diaspora. And he served every prime minister, and if you haven't read the book, this is your reading for the next couple of weeks. The Prime Ministers, Yehuda Avner. It'll keep you busy for a long time. It's a fabulous book. Prime Ministers, and it's a great book. Great for the winter reading, long evenings. Fabulous book. Especially when he talks about Menachem Begin. This is the... You read the book,
Well, Janet and I had the screws up. We brought him in.
Ah, excellent.
And
great sense of humor, right? He had a great sense of humor.
Going back, we stayed overnight
English.
Here at the Grand Plaza, and his daughter called, and she said, how's my father getting home?
Yeah.
We had a thing. So we said, we're free, and she said, could you bring him back? So we had the honor
of
bringing him up to Riverdale.
Well, it's a long drive.
By ourselves.
And I can guarantee you, he didn't stop talking the whole time. He's a great guy. He passed away a few years ago. So
we
live rocker.
We dropped him off and going to me.
Yeah.
No, I parked the car. We had to go up to his daughter's apartment.
Yeah, Riverdale. Yeah.
Coffee came and we sat there.
Wonderful. He was such a what you call in Yiddish a tyriid. He really was a very special man, and a great sense of humor and really something. So I'll tell you a little story. It's not in the book, but I'm reminded of this story because the families knew each other very well. He came, he paid a shiva call when my father-in-law passed away. My mother was sitting in Yerushalayim, and he came especially to be Menachem Ova. I met him over the years. He told the story like this, Camp David, right? The whole Egyptian agreement, what happened. He said that he was flying with the Israeli delegation to sign the peace with Egypt. And what happened was that at the time, who was the prime minister? Begin. Begin came in 77. This was in 1979.
Yeah, Begin were close.
Very close. Because he appreciated, but he said Begin really was the only Jewish prime minister we've ever had, like in the real sense of the word. Begin was really something unique. So what happened? They're on the aeroplane, and they're flying to Camp David, and it's Parsha Vayishlach, last week's Sedra, right? It was around this time of year. And Begin, in the middle of the flight, stands up. He's going to make a speech. Begin was very good at making speeches. And he just makes an announcement. And he says, has anyone in the group here got a chumash? So they all look at each other because it's mainly a secular bunch of Israelis. And of course, who's got the chumash? Yehuda Avner. He's taking the chumash with him. He's going to go to shul in Washington or wherever. So he's got the chumash. So he says, Bo Yehuda, come here. And he sits with him and he says, we have to learn Parshat Vayishlach together. So Vayishlach, the story of Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esau. Because he says, I'm going to deal now with Esau. I need to know what the Torah says about how Yaakov negotiated with Esau, what we've got to say, what we've got to... This, for Begin, was a real deal. And they sat, can you imagine, Prime Minister of Israel, and he's sitting learning Chumash with Yehuda Avner on the plane going to sign the deal. Unbelievable story. And when I heard that story, it's not in the book, but he's, I mean, for every story that he has in the book, he's got 10 stories which he didn't put in the book. But that one to me says volumes about him, Avner, and it says volumes about Begin. And this is what we're saying over here. Esther understood this tradition, that when we are in a time of trouble, in a time of conflict or whatever it may be, our source of action, where our guidebook, what we need to read is the Torah. And listen, let's go back to this. And that story is one of my favorites. And there are a few others, but that one's really something else. The story with him and LBJ, I just got to tell you this if you haven't read it. He was invited by LBJ to go with President Eshkol to the ranch. And as they're going, LBJ says, come on, let's get into the Jeep and we'll show you the whole, you know, he drives for literally 5 hours and doesn't get anywhere near the end of the ranch. And they're bumping along and whatever and ever, and LBJ with his accent, which is pretty heavy, is talking to Eshkol. And Eshkol is nodding, and Eshkol is saying, good, and Eshkol is doing this. And in the middle of it, he turns around, because Yehuda Avner is sitting in the back. And Yehuda Avner looks at him, and Eshkol looks at him, and Eshkol says in Yiddish, he says, Vos zok de goy? What is he saying? What is he talking about? He didn't understand one word of this whole conversation, which had been going on for like 3 hours. Vos zok de goy? It's such a great story. Because, you know, you can just imagine, you know, the stories of LBJ and what he was like. It makes perfect sense. And, you know, Israeli prime ministers are famous for their little touches like that. It's a very, very funny story. All right. Back to the text. Listen to this. So, we're wondering about the thing of tomorrow, right? The famous Shakespeare, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, right? So why is it tomorrow? Ela says the comment here from the Midrash, Yadash Zarash al Amalek Lemudim Lipol Bacherv Lemachar. Really, Amalek was all about winning the battle by tomorrow. V'cheinu Omer B'Yimei Moshe says with Moses, V'tzei Elochem B'Amalek Machar. He told Joshua, go out and fight Amalek tomorrow. Anin Itzav Al Hagiva. Not only that, but tomorrow I'll be davening for you. Right? And that's why he held up his hands and the Jews were davening, etc. Ubi Yemei Shaul, and even with Saul, when he fought the battle, which we're going to, again, remember before Purim, Ka'et Machar. It's all about tomorrow. Eshlach Elea Ish Mibinyamin. It's going to be the battle tomorrow. So what he says over here, Esther said, I'm fighting Amalek, I've got to go by the rules. Tomorrow is when I fight. He doesn't explain why. Why do you need this 24-hour waiting period? Maybe to prepare yourself spiritually, to think of everything that you can do which is positive against the negativity of Amalek. I'm not sure. But he says, listen to what he writes. This is Yeshua Bachran. This is the last point for today. V'yesh lishol. Mara Moshe litchod lemachar. So why did Moses wait for tomorrow? V'alo Amalek v'abba v'yicha v'yilechem b'Yisrael. Amalek was ready to fight today. Ela shekva lamadnu ki shonehi milchemet Amalek mikol milchamot shemilchem Yisrael. The war with Amalek is different completely. She'ein letofsa b'gayon haposho. You don't use logic when you fight Amalek. Shehi tzricha chana. When you fight Amalek, you've got to get the soldiers who are the most righteous. Because it's a spiritual battle. It's a battle where Amalek comes along and says, I want to destroy you because you represent the God of Israel. Not because of the fact you're Jewish, but who you are connected to. Amalek does not accept the existence of God. And therefore, to fight him, you need to get the tzaddikim, the righteous man. Haro'im la'asota, v'chein b'tfilat. And therefore the same thing with the prayer. It's a unique situation that you need Moses to daven for you because you're fighting something so intense. Just two lines down after the comment here, he brings the Zohar, a comment from the Kabbalistic literature. He says, Machar shezel amolek hu echad mechamesha mikraot she'ein la betorat HaKatov. Basically, he's Kaloma. What does he mean to say? If Shalikra HaKatov. In other words, the way we read the Pasuk is debatable, but he basically points out, even though we may not understand fully why we have to wait, but it's within the parameters of what was established by Moshe Rabbeinu in the original battle with Amalek. It's got to be Machar. Now, how long Machar is, it can take 24 hours. When they were fighting against Germany, it took 6 years. And that was a long Machar. And during that Machar, look how we suffered. In the end, Molech was overcome again. But the reality of it is that there has to be this period of, I think, two things. Number one, recognizing the problem, and then gathering together enough of a strength to be able to combat it. And thank God today a million times that we're in this position, Eretz Israel, where there is an ability to fight Amalek. If you call the Iranians Amalek, whatever you do, Reb Soloveitchik was said, anyone who is standing up against the existence of the Jews today has got the definition of Amalek without question. Call it the Iranians, call it the Hezbollah, whatever, all these evil groups. The reality of it is, thank God, we have that ability to prepare for those battles as and when they have to be fought. But the principle is preparation. And that is what Esther is doing here. She is saying, I know that meal number one, I could spill the beans and what will be, will be. And you know what? The king was in such a shock that she actually even had the chutzpah to come in and be in the palace. I might get away with it, but I might not. She might see this as a situation where the king will see Esther as ganging up with Haman against the king. And before you look round, she makes a request and she says, but why is Haman here? What's he doing here? Ah, obviously you're ganging up against me. Therefore, boom, off she goes and she's killed. So you know what? It makes sense that it's going to be tomorrow. Do meal number two. At that point, there's going to be a change because she's waiting for some sort of sign from God. She's now daven for some ot. She hopes there'll be a sign. Of course, between meal number one and meal number two, the king has a sleepless night. That's the sign from Hashem. And therefore, that's the whole development which we're going to read. Please go next time in chapter 6. There is a development between the two meals. But the very fact that she goes to the next meal, says Rabbi Baruch, is not just a practical thing, but it's actually a biblical thing. It's a thing which she has learned from Torah. And what is so precious, so beautiful about this whole story, even if you say she was this quintessential Jewess from the beginning, or was saying, as we said to Rav Lau, that she becomes that leader, and Mordechai becomes the leader as well, and they adopt the role which they are seem to be fitting into, the reality of it is that part of what happens to them, the Jewish awareness becomes so important, and they start looking at Jewish history. When people start becoming connected to Am Yisrael and haven't been connected for so long, one of the ways to connect them is to say, look at what we've been through. Look at the stories of Jewish history. Not so much the sad stories are there, but look at the incredible characters that we've had, the leaders that we've had. Look at the stories from the previous generation or two generations. Look at what happened, certain things which were so inspiring. We're coming up during the winter vacation now. There's going to be the Seir Mashas. Seir Mashas is there's going to be 100,000 people gathering somewhere in New York, New Jersey, and where it's going to be, celebrating the completion of the whole Gemara. Every one of them sat down and learned the whole Talmud. And I'm saying to myself, this was a mind of a great rabbi from the middle of the 1920s, Meir Shapiro, died. He was 30, he was 47 when he died in 1934, and he had this vision of two Jews meeting on a train somewhere in the middle of nowhere. One coming from Lithuania, one coming from Poland. They've got nothing to talk about. And all of a sudden, they each take out their Gemara and they're on the same page. And they start discussing, well, you say this and I say that. And they start having a chavrusa, they learn together. That was a brilliant, brilliant idea. And it went around the world. And by now, in Israel, there are thousands, and around the world, there are tens of thousands, all over the world. There's even this year, a women's seer. There's a group of women somewhere in New York who are holding a seer in Israel also, who are having... Correct. They're finishing the Talmud. And, it's a phenomenon. And these are the characters I always argued that, the people I wanted to meet. And he's on my list of the people I wanted to meet. Be they biblical, be they from the modern age. There are Jews that you just read their history, their story, they're inspiring. And that is what Esther does. She knows the precedent is in the Bible. And if I've got to go and take the lead against Amalek, how do I go about it? And one of the things she sees, machar, the idea of machar. Next time, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to come to keyword number two. Keyword number two, we've had today, malkah. And I tried to show you how makar works with and without the use of the word. And keyword number two, which is more bound up with Amalek, is going to be the word mikre. Amalek is about happenstance. Amalek says everything happens by chance. There's no God. Amalek is godless. And we'll see that a lot of the chapter 5, chapter 6, revolves around that key word of Asher Korecha Baderech Mikre. Things that we say are the hand of God, Amalek rejects that. So the battle against Amalek is based on the issue, obviously, of what Amalek represents as a physical threat, but more the spiritual threat, which never goes away. Nebuch, we keep seeing the Amalek come out all the time now. They seem to have a brazenness all of a sudden. The anti-Semitic are coming out of the woodwork. What happened in Jersey City, we can only pray for comfort for the people who are suffering that terrible, terrible event. And it's just worrying. But again, let's get inspiration from the story, from Esther, from Mordechai. These are incredible people. And becoming what they became is so inspiring. I can just leave you with that thought as we go into the break and Bezrat Hashem to be continued. January 22nd. Please read on, chapter 6. Read the next chapter. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful break. Thank you so much.